Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And I'd like to welcome back to the program today Philip Kerr. He joins us by telephone from New York City, and he's got a new book out. Philip, welcome back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
I get so excited when I see that you have a new book coming out.
Thank you.
And this one, I got an advanced copy of it, and I picked it up, and it was hefty. It was long, and I just thought, oh, good. It's a long book.
Well, is it? Yeah, I mean, I guess I must have got carried away, actually. That's always a good sign. I didn't mean it to be long. It just sort of seemed to come out that way, actually. And even in the event, you know, I sort of ended it I don't know, maybe sooner than I could have done, actually. You know, I could have. But I like to sort of, you know, I think when an end presents itself, you think, oh, well, let's stop now. That's enough.
Yeah. Well, the last book, was the last book when he was in Prague?
That's correct.
Okay. Now we catch up with Bernie Gunther, and it's 1943, and things aren't going very well on the Eastern Front.
No, it was just after Stalingrad, which, of course, was the big turning point when the German army was encircled by the Soviets, and after huge carnage, many of them taken off to Soviet prison camps, never to be seen again.
Some of our listeners probably aren't familiar with Bernie. Can you give us a little capsule biography?
Yes, he's a left-wing stroke social democratic policeman. He doesn't like the Nazis, doesn't like them at all, has always tried to live his life as independently of them as possible. But unfortunately, because he is a good policeman, in the sense that he's efficient and seems to know what he's doing, he's the sort of person that the Nazis like to use. They were very good at that. They were very good at using people regardless of their political affiliations. They made it sort of slightly impossible for you to say no, which is understandable sometimes when you're dealing with the kind of people that that Bernie ends up dealing with. So in this particular book, he finds himself told to do something by Goebbels, who was the Minister of Propaganda. And Goebbels is one of those guys that you really couldn't say no to, not if you, you know, wanted to walk the streets of Berlin as a free man.
Mm. And he gets an assignment with a group called the War Crimes Bureau, and I was really surprised to hear about the existence of this group.
Yes, I think most people are. Well, you see, at the end of during the First World War, The Prussian army had a war crimes investigation bureau, which was rather like the French or the British. We regarded there was a proper way to conduct a war, and there would be cases brought against not just foreign soldiers who committed what were seen to be war crimes, but your own side as well. And the Wehrmacht in 1939 decided to do the same thing again, because they thought, well, you know, the SS can look after their own discipline. What they do is their own affair. We're an organization run by gentlemen, quite often aristocrats, and we think there's a proper way to conduct ourselves as an army. So the irony, and I love these ironies when I'm writing, is that, you know, you might literally have a case of the SS sort of murdering tens of thousands of people 5 miles up the road from where the Wehrmacht was in the process of charging a sergeant with a war crime for something as simple as robbing an old woman, and that's the kind of hypocrisy that sort of makes an interesting novel.
The book is A Man Without Breath. Philip Kerr wrote it. He joins us on the program today. The book just came out, and he just landed in America. Are you still living in England?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Okay. We also have the whole situation with the uniforms. You mentioned the SS and the Wehrmacht, the disparity between what could be going on just a few miles down the road. Well, depending upon what uniform Bernie is wearing when he shows up in Smolensk, he gets different sorts of responses, doesn't he?
Yes. Well, he turns out wearing a uniform of the SD, which was the intelligence division of the SS. And they weren't very popular with the Wehrmacht, but at the same time, it was very common for people who'd been policemen to be drafted into the SD. So Bernie sort of is obliged to make clear to his hosts quite quickly that he may be wearing the uniform of the SD, but he doesn't really have very much in common with the police people who run it. Now, the people who run the Wehrmacht, who are the people he's who are his hosts, are quite often people with a von in their name, sort of gentlemen, barons, and Bernie doesn't really have much time for them either.
Prussian nobility.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. And when he arrives there, he finds the field marshal who's in charge is mainly into acting like a country lord. He wants to go hunting, and he has a what's this guy, a putzer, would you call it?
The putzer, yeah, he has a Russian putzer who was a kind of Batman, or you'd say a servant, really. I mean, someone who polishes your boots and, you know, cleans your rifle, that sort of thing.
And he's surrounded by intrigue. We have other Vons, other Prussian noblemen officers who are traveling to Smolensk, and Bernie's observing some rather odd activity.
Yes, well, unwittingly, Bernie is walking into a part of the world that was a hotbed of opposition and intrigue against Adolf Hitler. Many of these people were people who had already tried to kill Hitler, and would indeed try several times. And indeed, Bernie's asked to investigate the Katyn Forest massacre, and the man who had actually discovered the bones of the first Polish soldier buried there is an aristocrat who himself had made two separate attempts to kill Hitler in the previous 2 months. So a lot of these guys are not friends of Hitler at all, and are very suspicious of anyone who's coming into their midst.
I know you do a lot of research, and I'm just going to guess that most of these individuals really existed.
Oh, yes. Yes, I mean, nearly all of them, actually. Wherever possible, I like to write between the lines of existing history. It makes it sort of more real. It makes it more interesting to me. I don't like to make things up unnecessarily. I think it's a sort of failure if I'm obliged to you just make something up. At the same time, I always think the best research, the best stuff one writes is the stuff one makes up oneself. It's like knowing when to stop using the research and when to start using your imagination. So I like to fill in the blanks, as it were, with fiction rather than just completely imagine something from the very beginning.
Well, it's really fun as a reader, particularly someone like me who just loves this series and loves Bernie Gunther, to have him meeting the propaganda minister, or to have him just missing running into Hitler.
Yes. Well, Hitler's always a kind of, he's the ultimate bogeyman, and I like to sort of tease the reader almost with sort of near misses. So Bernie has to stand and endure sort of one of Hitler's long speeches, knowing full well that the man who is going to be taking Hitler around a museum after the speech is someone who's about to assassinate Hitler by a suicide bombing. I mean, what's not known is generally that some of these aristocrats, some of these generals, some of these colonels who were involved in the plots to kill Hitler were very, very brave men. And indeed, this particular man, who I have the highest regard for, who was a baron, Rudolf Christoph Freiherr von Gerstorff, he packed his pockets with landmines and hoped during a tour of the museum in Berlin, the military museum, that he could detonate them and kill Hitler, and indeed kill himself at the same time. And these things really did happen. I mean, at the same time, there was something rather endearingly inept about mm-hmm. them as well, because this was the same man who'd also been involved in a plot to blow up Hitler's plane. So as Bernie himself reflects, you know, for all the fact that they were generals and colonels who'd led millions to slaughter during the First World War, they actually weren't very good at just killing one man in particular.
Well, the combination of their bumbling and Hitler's paranoia made it very difficult.
Indeed. Yes. I mean, Hitler was very lucky, you know, given that there were probably as many as 30 different attempts to kill him between sort of 1930 and 1945. He was extraordinarily fortunate. And indeed, this is what sort of gave him the sense that he was chosen by God, that he was fulfilling a destiny. It was the knowledge that he'd avoided being killed on many occasions, and he took this to be a sign.
So Bernie shows up in Smolensk, and they're nervous in Smolensk. And there's a lot of intrigue going on here. And for those of us who have read some of your books in this series, we can expect a few things to happen. One thing we can expect is that there's going to be a homicide, and Bernie's going to get involved in the investigation. And another thing that we usually will expect is that a really beautiful woman will appear on the scene, and he will be smitten.
Yes. Well, the Cat in Forest massacre is the main event, which sort of prefaces Bernie's arrival in the area. And Goebbels had decided that they should investigate this, knowing full well that it was the Russians who were responsible, in the hope that they could exploit it for propaganda purposes. And so an international commission of forensic surgeons and doctors was detailed to go to Smolensk from as many as 15 different countries. Many of these professors had assistants, and some of those assistants were indeed women. So I sort of felt, you know, when I found that out, it was a fairly legitimate legitimate explanation for why you know, an attractive lady forensic pathologist would be arriving in that particular area, who Bernie, of course, has a sort of dalliance with. No decent sort of noir novel would be complete without one, almost.
The attraction does seem to be mutual for a little bit.
For a little bit, yes.
Yeah. But unfortunately, Bernie gets himself into lots of situations where he has to make decisions. And this is another thing that we learn to expect is the moral ambiguity he faces between deciding what's right and what's going to keep him alive.
Indeed. And he makes choices that, you know, I know some people find it hard to take. I think some people expect heroes to behave in a consistently heroic way. I sort of tend to be the kind of person who believes that heroes are mostly people who behave heroically at certain times, and at other times they behave rather less heroically. That makes a much more interesting character to write about, a much more believable character to write about. I don't believe that people are always on their best behavior. And the more one reads about sort of, you know, our heroes during World War II and whatever, they often turn out to be people who have feet of clay like the rest of us. Who've behaved heroically on perhaps only one or two occasions.
Hmm. Philip Kerr has joined us. His new novel, a Bernie Gunther novel, is A Man Without Breath. And we also have the shadow of the Spanish Civil War.
Yes, because one of the doctors who's detailed to come out with the Forensic Medical Commission, the International Forensic Medical Commission, which is a real thing, it really did happen, was a Spanish pathologist, and he is he's someone who has a pretty dark history himself from the Spanish Civil War. I think it's, you know, people forget just how vicious that war actually was, and there's something in his history that sort of influences the plot. Yes.
So a lot of our listeners probably aren't aware that you originally wrote three books about Bernie Gunther, and then you stopped. And I don't think you really planned to write any more at the time, and you took a long break, and then you started writing them again. Did that long break make a difference?
Yes, it made a difference in all sorts of ways, actually. You see, I'd sort of stopped because I thought a lot of crime writers just climb on a treadmill and then just sort of they sort of push out one book a year featuring the same character again and again and again. And I just wanted to sort of do some other stuff for a while. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll come back to the character, maybe I won't. It was, you know, it's the typical arrogance of youth. You assume that people will still be interested. And it was my good fortune that the publisher collected the three existing books as an omnibus edition called Berlin Noir. And as a result, over the years, the books built up a sort of critical mass. So by the time 16 years later, when I came back to do another one, quite a lot of people were ready for it and indeed sort of keen on it. So I sort of felt I was, you know, I had a sort of built-in market already there, which was rather gratifying. I'm not sure how many more I can do. That's the thing. I mean, because I work with real history and try and make them come out of real history. You know, there's only a limited amount of history to work with. And so with each one now, I sort of think, well, I don't know. Can I do another one? I don't know. It's each one becomes progressively more difficult and more of a challenge. I think most, and I'm always haunted by the possibility that I've written too many. I think if you're worth your salt as a writer, you should always be asking yourself those sorts of questions anyway. You know, should I pack it in, move on, do something else?
Well, you keep finding interesting periods in his life, and we swing back and forth on this pendulum where we could be at a prisoner of war camp, or we could be at a hotel in Berlin, or in Argentina, or Cuba in
yes.
the 50s. You know, it's really fun to hop on that pendulum and see, okay.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I mean, I think it's good to be unpredictable. I think, you know, if it just becomes, you know, something that people always, you know, or always know where they're going to start and roughly what's going to happen, I think it becomes a bit dull. So, yes, I do like to mix it up a bit. Just for that reason.
Well, I really hate to ask this, but is there another book coming out next year?
I don't know, actually. I'm sort of toying with some ideas for a story right now, and I've got an idea, but I haven't started writing anything. So, but this is only April, so you know, there's plenty of time to go. But I would hope there'd be at least another one. Yes.
The book is A Man Without Breath. Philip Kerr has joined us on the program, and this is the second book in a row where we've been able to track you down. I'm so glad that they're sending you over here to do some events.
Well, so am I. I will say there's only one thing worse than doing an American book tour, and it's not being asked to do an American book tour.
Oh, that's good. So we have this situation in Smolensk where the Germans are getting nervous because they know the Red Army is going to be coming back through. And as any student of history knows, that was a horrible, relentless revenge that came back through. So there's a lot of shaky, nervous Germans occupying this territory. And then here's Bernie walking around trying to investigate some crimes, and he finds a very interesting thing at a hospital.
You have to remind me here, actually. I mean,
this doctor at this hospital knows some things.
Ah, yes. Well, the doctor, it turns out, knows not only is one of his patients. Who he sort of has been looking after, who's a sort of man who suffered apparently some sort of injury to the head, is one of the perpetrators of the Cat and Forest massacre. He's one of the murderers perhaps I just say something about the Cat and Forest massacre in that when the Germans and the Russians made a treaty in 1939, they agreed to divide Poland between them, and the Polish army put up a resistance, and those Poles who were arrested by the Russians were taken off to camps, and most often just murdered. And there were sort of special murder squads that the Russians used to carry out these mass mass executions, who were sort of quite often the absolute dregs of society who carried out the murders sort of rather drunkenly. And one of these murderers has had a bit of an accident and is now in the hospital in Smolensk, unknown to everyone.
I think it's fascinating. We look at history and certain things stand out, and then we forget other things. And the animosity that the Soviets and the Russians before them and the Germans seem to feel towards Poland, it goes back a long way in history, back to Catherine the Great. Back to that war that the Russians lost in, 1925?
Yes, that was quite soon after the Russian Revolution. There was a war between the Poles and the Russians, and the Russians got a pretty bloody nose. Stalin never forgot this. He'd been partly involved himself in the military campaign, and as a result, he'd nursed a deep hatred of the Poles forever after. Really, when the opportunity came, he was determined to decimate the intellectual class, and that would be the basis of any future opposition to Soviet control.
I've always been tickled by the way you made the transition from attorney to novelist. I think that's a very interesting story.
Well, I was a hopeless lawyer, so there's perhaps not that surprising. It was but doubly fortunate for any potential clients I might have had that I became a novelist rather than remained a lawyer. Certainly had no talent for it, actually, nor interest. It was one of those jobs that one took on because, like a lot of young men going to university, my dad thought, it was a good kind of degree to get and that you wouldn't ever be unemployed. And he used to say, there's no such thing as an unemployed lawyer. And and he was kind of right. But, it just wasn't where my heart lay. And, I'd been writing stories since I'd been, a kid. And I knew perfectly well, as soon as I could do it, I'd be, I'd be writing full time if I could get away with it. And so I soon gave up the law and became an advertising copywriter, which suited me much more because I wasn't particularly interested in doing an honest day's work. And the great thing about being an advertising copywriter in those days was that as long as you were bent over your IBM Selectric typewriter typing away, people assumed you were actually working, which is not an unreasonable assumption. But in fact, quite often I was actually, this is when I was working at Saatchi's actually, I was quite often actually working on my novel. Which was great. It was much more, it was like having an arts council subsidy, really.
and the fascination that you have with the German history, tell us how that came in.
Well, because I was such a hopeless undergraduate lawyer, I decided to delay the inevitable as far as employment was concerned, by becoming a postgraduate lawyer. I did a postgraduate degree in German law and philosophy, which is also a way of giving myself a much-needed education because, all I knew really was law. It sort of appealed to me to sort of kind of educate myself. And so it was an excuse just to read a lot of German philosophy, and I guess that's really what sort of brought about a kind of interest in the sort of philosophical, cultural, and historical background to the whole Nazi period, which still seems to me to be, possibly the most interesting historical event since the Reformation, which was also started by another German, who was anti-Semitic, Martin Luther. I guess that's really where the whole interest came about. I mean, and of course we live with the consequences of what happened then all the time. I mean, it's people sort of often talk about it as if it's in something that happened in the past. It seems to me that it's an ever-present thing in all our lives.
Philip Kerr has been our guest today. His book is A Man Without Breath. How many cities are you going to hit on this tour?
Possibly as many as 10 or 12, actually.
Nice.
It's coast to coast, yes.
So Los Angeles for sure.
Los Angeles, San Francisco, Houston, Phoenix, Washington, Miami, Delray Beach. Did I say Houston? Detroit.
Yeah. Detroit.
Detroit, yes.
Wow.
Well, everybody I've mentioned to, the fact that I was going to Detroit, has said the same thing, you know. So I thought, I don't, perhaps people in Detroit would feel slightly irritated on.
Well, actually, my producer is from the Detroit area, and he's up here giving the thumbs up when you said Detroit. That's why I said, wow.
Right.
You don't hear about too many book tours going through Detroit, but I think that's wonderful.
Well, I'm going to somewhere in Shula Books in Grand River Avenue, Okemos.
Uh-huh.
Okemos, I'm not quite sure. That's near Detroit as well. So, they're giving me, I'm seeing as much. I feel like George Kaplan in North by Northwest. You know, I'm sort of going right across the United States. The pity is that I'm not accompanied by an Eva Marie Saint, to sort of mop my fevered brow.
Oh,
but, you know,
Philip Kerr, his new book is A Man Without Breath, and I'm just going to cross my fingers and hope that you've got at least one more Bernie Gunther in you somewhere, even if I have to wait 16 years for it.
Well, I can guarantee it won't be 16 years, but yeah, I think there's probably going to be another one.
Okay. And I hope that you enjoy your tour, and we'll definitely be watching out for whatever it is you're working on.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Vic.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. The book is A Man Without Breath by Philip Kerr, just published by Putnam. And if you're listening in one of those cities that he mentioned, he will be coming through on his book tour here in the next couple of weeks. So you can have an opportunity to meet him and maybe find out more about what Bernie's been up to. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Tune in next week when my guest will be Joe Hill. Here's an excerpt from his new novel, Nosferatu. Bing liked the ads in the back of the pulps. Ads for tin lockers filled with toy soldiers. Recreate the thrill of Verdun. Ads for vintage World War II equipment. Bayonets, rifles, gas masks. Ads for books that would tell you how to make women want you. Teacher to say I love you. He often clipped out order forms and sent in pocket change or grimy dollar bills in an attempt to acquire ant farms and metal detectors. He wanted with all his heart to amaze his friends and astonish his relatives, and never mind that his friends were the three Phoebes who worked under him in the janitorial crew at Norchem Farm, and that his only direct relatives had returned to the soil in the cemetery behind the New American Faith Tabernacle. Bing had never once considered that his father's collection of softcore pulps, mildewing in a cardboard box down in Bing's quiet room, were older than he was, and that most of the corporations he was sending money to had long since ceased to exist. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.